Hey everyone, and welcome back for another deep dive with us. Today we're going way back, like way, way back to the very beginnings of the FBI, like even before, you know, the name FBI even existed, and long before J. Edgar Hoover, you know, became like the face of the agency. You might think you know the FBI, but its roots are like seriously tangled up in all sorts of things, like Teddy Roosevelt's whole trust-busting era, and even the Mexican Revolution. With twists and turns, you just wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's a wild story, one that's often overlooked. We're going to be using excerpts from a couple of books today. Beginnings and Preface, they both focus on this early period of the FBI's history to really kind of unpack this whole era.
Awesome. I'm excited to dive in. So let's set the stage. It's the early 1900s. President Teddy Roosevelt, he's on a mission to rein in these corporate monopolies and land grabbers. His attorney general, Charles J. Bonaparte, he's the one tasked with actually enforcing all these laws. But
a big one, the Department of Justice. They just didn't have the manpower. To handle these really complex investigations, they had to rely on borrowing agents from the Secret Service, which, you can imagine, wasn't exactly ideal. It's kind of like trying to run a kitchen without your own set of knives.
Oh, that's a great analogy. Yeah, I can see how that would be so frustrating for Bonaparte. Like, you're trying to uphold the law, but you're constantly, like, at the mercy of another department. So what did he do about it?
Well, in 1907, Bonaparte went to Congress and requested funding to create a dedicated detective force within the DOJ. But Congress? Well, they weren't too keen on the idea, maybe feeling a little bit stung. After the DOJ had investigated some of their own members for land fraud, they weren't exactly eager to give the DOJ even more power.
Yeah, that makes sense. Congress is always wary of, you know, any agency gaining too much power, especially one that could potentially investigate them, so.
What did Bonaparte do? Did he just give up? Not at all. He was a pretty clever guy. He found a workaround. Using a miscellaneous expense fund, he went ahead and hired 10 former Secret Service agents. This is in 1908. And effectively, he created the Bureau of Investigation, or BI, without any explicit approval from Congress. It was a bold move, born out of necessity, and maybe just a touch of defiance.
Wow, that's incredible. The birth of the FBI, not through some grand legislative act, but like a bit of budgetary maneuvering. It really makes you wonder how different things might have been if Congress had just approved his request from the start. So,
okay, we have this new agency, the BI, essentially the proto-FBI, up and running. Who was in charge of shaping this like fledgling organization?
Well, the first chief of the BI was a man named Stanley Finch. Described as meticulous and incredibly driven. Imagine working your way up through the ranks of the DOJ while also attending law school at night. Talk about dedication. And historian Ethan Theo Harris, who you might know from his work on the FBI, actually credits Finch, not Hoover, with establishing a lot of the organizational practices that we associate with the Bureau today. Wow. Finch, the unsung hero, laying the groundwork for what would eventually become one of the most powerful law enforcement agencies in the world. It really does challenge the typical Hoover-centric narrative, doesn't it? So what was life like for those early BI agents? Were they like battling gangsters in smoky back rooms or conducting high-speed chases?
Well, reality was probably a bit less glamorous than the Hollywood version. Think mountains of paperwork, daily reports, expense tracking, even detailed accounts of baths taken while on assignment. All meticulously reviewed, of course, by Finch himself. They carried .38 caliber revolvers, but their day-to-day work involved a lot more penmanship than gunplay.
Oh, man. Sounds like some things never change. Paperwork and bureaucracy are timeless, but there must have been some key differences compared to the later Hoover era.
Right, absolutely. The early BI was much smaller, less structured, and operated with a lot more flexibility. Beginnings describes the agents as rough riders, which I think captures their independent spirit and willingness to kind of improvise. They even experiment with the new technology, like the dictograph, an early listening device.
Right.
That is the book notes. Was a complete failure.
That's hilarious. It shows they were trying to be innovative, even if the technology wasn't quite there yet. It really highlights the contrast between that early BI, with its trial and error approach, and the later, more rigid Hoover era. Okay, so we've got the scrappy group of agents, led by the meticulous Stanley Finch, tackling all sorts of cases. What was the first major challenge that really tested the BI?
Well, it's a case that really reveals both the ambition and the potential pitfalls of that early BI, the Charles W. Moore scandal. To understand this one, we have to go back to the Panic of 1907, a major financial crisis that brought down even titans like Charles W. Morse, known as the King of Ice, for his control of the ice industry.
Wow, the King of Ice. Okay, so we're talking about a high-profile case here with big money and even bigger personalities involved. How did the BI get entangled in all of this?
So Morse was convicted of violating the Donnelly Anti-Monopoly Act. But then he turned around and accused the BI of jury tampering to secure that conviction. The allegations were pretty serious, including claims that agents plied jurors with alcohol, concealed a juror's mental illness, and even fed them biased newspaper reports.
Wow, that's a serious accusation. Trying to influence a jury, that undermines the entire justice system. What happened next? This must have caused a major uproar.
Oh, it did. The scandal made headlines. It really rocked the BI, forcing them to confront the need for stricter procedures and greater accountability. It's a pivotal moment because it highlights the tension between achieving results and operating within the bounds of the law, a tension that would continue to define the BI and later the FBI.
It's fascinating how this scandal, which could have easily destroyed the young BI, ultimately pushed them towards a more rigorous and transparent approach. So the BI weathered the storm, then emerged, maybe a bit bruised, but with a renewed focus on operating by the book. Where did they go from there?
Well, by 1910, Congress, maybe impressed by the BI's performance, granted them more authority and funding. The BI grew rapidly, tackling a wider range of cases, from bank fraud and stolen government property to smuggling of Chinese immigrants and enforcement of the Mann Act.
The Mann Act. Now, that's a law that deserves a deeper look for our listeners who might not be familiar. The Mann Act, also known as the White Slave Traffic Act, made it illegal to transport women across state lines for immoral purposes. It really reflects the social anxieties of the time, particularly around female sexuality and the perceived threat of white slavery. But it was also a law that was ripe for abuse, often used to target individuals based on their morals rather than any actual criminal activity.
It's definitely a complex and controversial law that opens up a discussion about the intersection of morality, law enforcement, and social control in the early 20th century. It's a great example of how the BI's mandate was expanding beyond just traditional crime fighting and into areas that blurred the lines between law enforcement and social engineering.
For sure. We talked about Stanley Finch's meticulous nature, but just how hands-on was he with the growing BI?
Oh, let's just say, Finch took micromanagement to an art form. Beginnings is full of anecdotes about his obsession with detail. We're talking about a man who would reprimand agents for exceeding porterage allowances by mere 10 cents, demand uniform paper sizes for reports, and even dictate the proper way to charge for baths on expense reports.
That's amazing. Well, that level of control might seem excessive today. It speaks to Finch's determination to create a culture of efficiency and accountability within the BI. In a way, he was trying to instill a sense of professionalism in a field that was still defining itself.
Exactly. And remember, this is an era before standardized law enforcement procedures. Finch was essentially creating a blueprint for how a modern investigative agency should operate.
It's amazing how these seemingly mundane details, like paper sizes and bath charges, can reveal so much about the culture and priorities of an organization. But as meticulously as Finch was running things back home, the world was about to throw the BI a major curveball, the Mexican Revolution.
Oh, yeah. The Mexican Revolution, which raged from 1910 to 1920, wasn't just some distant conflict that spilled over the border, creating instability and security concerns for the U.S. The BI was suddenly tasked with enforcing neutrality laws, a mission that would prove to be a trial by fire for the young agency.
So we're talking about a domestic law enforcement agency suddenly thrust into the world of international intrigue and conflict. What kind of challenges did they face?
Well, imagine trying to differentiate between all these different Mexican factions, each with their own agendas and loyalties. You're dealing with unreliable informants, navigating the shifting sands of U.S. foreign policy, and trying to decipher intercepted messages, all while operating in a volatile and often dangerous environment. It was crash course in intelligence gathering, counterintelligence, and the complexities of international relations.
That's a far cry from scrutinizing expense reports. It sounds like the Mexican Revolution forced the BI to adapt and innovate on the fly, developing skills and strategies that would shape the agency for years to come. But we'll have to dive into that more in part two of this deep dive, so stay tuned. Welcome back to the deep dive. Before the break, we were talking about how the Mexican Revolution really pushed the BI, like way out of its comfort zone, forcing them to deal with all this international intrigue and espionage.
It really was a turning point for them. They had to adapt and innovate in ways they probably never even imagined. Remember, this is the early 20th century. The U.S. intelligence apparatus as we know it today just didn't exist. The BI was basically forging a path in the wilderness, creating techniques and strategies that would shape intelligence gathering for the entire nation.
So they were learning on the job. With like incredibly high stakes. I mean, it's like being thrown into the deep end of a pool and having to learn to swim while dodging bullets. What were some of the specific challenges the BI faced during the Mexican Revolution?
Well, one of the biggest was just trying to make sense of the chaos. See, the revolution wasn't a single entity. You had all these different factions vying for power, constantly shifting alliances. It was a web of guesses.
Yeah.
Political and personal motivations for the BI. We're used to dealing with much more straightforward criminal cases. This was a whole new level of complexity.
It must have been like trying to solve a jigsaw puzzle with half the pieces missing.